This is Lawrence Spivak inviting you to Meet the Press with Governor Jimmy Carter of Georgia.
Meet the Press, America's press conference of the air and the world's oldest network television program, is a public affairs presentation of NBC News.
Meet the Press is brought to you by Exxon. Over the next 4 years, Exxon plans a record capital spending program of more than $16 billion to find more energy and to get this energy to work for its customers. In the U.S. and around the world, Exxon will be searching for new reserves of oil and natural gas. To move this energy, Exxon plans a sizable investment in supertankers and the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. At the same time, we'll be supplying nuclear fuel and working to develop ways to turn America's abundant coal reserves into synthetic gas. We also plan to expand our refineries and chemical plants to help meet today's increased demand. $16 billion. That's what Exxon plans to spend finding more energy and getting it to its customers.
Our guest today on Meet the Press is Governor Jimmy Carter of Georgia, who this week announced his candidacy for the 1976 Democratic presidential nomination. Governor Carter is a graduate of the U.S. Naval Academy and worked under Admiral Hyman Rickover on the development of the first nuclear submarines. In 1962, he was elected to the Georgia State Senate, and in 1970, he was elected governor. In this year's elections, Governor Carter served as chairman of the Democratic National Campaign Committee. We'll have the first question now from Douglas Kiker of NBC News.
Governor Carter, you're a candidate for the Democratic presidential nomination, so about two dozen other people. So many candidates, in fact, with no clear front runner and no more winner-take-all primaries for the Democrats, that the speculation is that the 1976 presidential nomination might end up being brokered, that it might be a brokered convention, that we'll be back in the smoke-filled rooms. Do you think that this is a possibility, and is this why you're running?
Mr. Kiker, first of all, I don't know but one more candidate who's announced, and that's Congressman Udall. And I think a lot of those that are being considered as possible candidates might very well not run. I think the new rules do contribute to a wider diversity of candidates who might enter, and also they put a tremendous responsibility on the candidate to enter more primaries. I plan at this point to enter all the primaries, although I would reserve the right to change my mind on one or two later on. The concept of a brokered convention is obnoxious to me. I don't believe that that's a proper approach to take. I'm going into the primaries and into the states that select delegates by conventions with the full intention of winning a majority of those delegates before the convention. And I think that anyone who enters the primary or the effort to get delegates on the basis of getting a small cadre of delegate support and then horse trading in a back room is violating the very spirit of what the new rules bring about.
You're a Southerner, Governor Carter. Do you believe that the voters of the United States of America are ready to accept a Southerner as a serious presidential candidate, a national candidate?
I think so. I believe that already my candidacy has been accepted on a wide-ranging basis as a viable candidacy, and that the attention that it has received in the national news media is an indication that I'm considered to be a serious candidate. And as I say, I'll be there when the last vote's counted, and I expect to win.
Thank you, Governor Carter. We'll be back to introduce our other panel members and continue the questions in just a minute. But first, this message from our alternate sponsor.
Last April, James Jonas was driving his new Buick across Veterans Bridge, Bay City, Michigan, when a pickup truck smashed into him head-on. Combined speed, about 100 miles an hour.
Nothing much happened to me. My wife, she got hurt some, but nothing serious. The guys in the truck got hurt real bad.
I'm Ed Reimers for Allstate, and here are the Jonases. Well, they bought that first Buick, the one in the wreck. They got it factory equipped with airbags. That decision may have saved their lives. Here's how the airbag works. In frontal crashes, today's airbag system is designed to automatically inflate in a split second, protect, and then deflate. The airbag protects the driver and front seat passenger automatically. That's why Allstate hopes all new cars will have airbags as standard equipment soon.
The day after the accident, I went down to the dealer and ordered the very same car, and I made very sure it had the airbags on it. I know they work because they did for us.
Now back to Meet the Press at Unrehearsed Press Conference. Here's our moderator, Lawrence Spivak.
We're ready now to resume our interview on Meet the Press. Our guest is Governor Jimmy Carter of Georgia, who just announced he will seek the 1976 Democratic presidential nomination. You've just met Douglas Kuiker of NBC News. The other questioners on our panel today are R.W. Apple Jr. of the New York Times, Frank Vanderlinden of the Nashville Banner, and David S. Broder of the Washington Post. We'll continue the questions now with Mr. Apple.
Governor, I'd like to follow up on a couple of the answers that you gave to Mr. Kuiker, if I might. First of all, you said you were going to enter all the primaries. Don't you believe, as so many of your fellow Democratic politicians believe, that Mr. Muskie showed pretty conclusively 2 years ago that trying to enter all the primaries is a waste of money and energy and political strength?
Mr. Apple, I would have to make a judgment on how much of my time to put into each state and how much money to spend there. But there are two things that have changed the basic concept. First of all, 70% of the delegates will be chosen in the primary election process. And secondly, now with a 15% proportional representation rule, if you get 15% of the votes in a state or a congressional district, you get 15% of the delegates. So I think this would be a very profound admission of weakness if you didn't enter a state and said, I can't get 15% of the votes in, say, Illinois. Also, I'm a full-time candidate. After January the 14th, I won't be governor anymore. And I intend to devote, for instance, in 1975, 250 working days outside of Georgia, laying the groundwork for successful campaigns in those states. So I think it's a viable promise. And I don't close the door of not entering a particular primary. My present intention, though, is to go into all of them.
But what you're saying is that you'll enter them all, but you will pick among the various primaries which ones you're going to concentrate on and try to score a big triumph in.
My intention is to win them all, of course, but I'll have to devote a certain portion of my time, depending on the size of the state, the number of delegates, the early nature of the primary, and what the political aspects are. For instance, I would probably be very careful to go into the states where major campaign opponents live, to show that my acceptability to the American people was widespread.
Now, you said also that the idea of a brokered convention was obnoxious to you.
Yes.
Isn't, in fact, a brokered convention of one sort or another about the best device there can be to develop and bring forward a candidate who is acceptable to all segments of the party?
In a way it is, but the brokered part that I was referring to was when a candidate who has a block of delegates committed to him speaks for his delegates. I would not be a party to entering a dark back room and horse trading the support of my delegates to some other candidate.
You're saying then that you would let, if you saw that you couldn't make it, you'd let your delegates go where they want to?
Basically, or either I would go where my delegates wanted me to go. I think the basic concept is that the candidate himself ought to represent what the people want and what his delegates prefer rather than the other way around.
Mr. Vanderlinden.
Governor Carter, your candidacy is widely viewed as part of a move to stop George Wallace from locking up the South for his efforts to win the Democratic presidential nomination. I'd like to ask, would you support Governor Wallace if he were chosen for either end of the Democratic ticket?
Mr. Vanderlinden, that's a hard question to answer. First of all, let me say that I am not running against George Wallace or against any of the other particular candidates. I'm running for the presidency. And I'm grateful that George Wallace is in it because when the reporters are on the way to Montgomery to interview George Wallace every couple of times a week, they quite often stop in Atlanta and get off, and I get a chance to meet some of them. But whether or not I'd support George Wallace on the ticket, I'll have to wait and see who the Republican nominee is. My intention now is to abide by the inclinations of the Democratic delegates at the convention and to support the nominees of the party.
Are you saying that your decision whether to support Wallace or not on the Democratic ticket depends on whom the Republicans nominate?
Well, I never have voted for George Wallace. I respect the delegates' judgment at the National Convention. My intention is to support the ticket that is selected by the delegates at the convention, including George Wallace.
Would you accept Wallace delegate support at the convention yourself?
Of course. In fact, I'm going to be fighting for the support of a lot of delegates who might presently think about voting George Wallace, or at least a lot of voters who support George Wallace. I will be going into the Alabama primary, for instance, to present myself as an alternative to Wallace. But I might hasten to say that I'll be seeking delegates in Texas, where Mr. Benson might be running from, and the state of Washington, where Senator Jackson might be running from. So I intend to meet head-on the prime candidates, if they come forth, within their own states.
Mr. Broder.
Governor Carter, you told us the other morning that you had informed Senator Talmadge of Georgia 2 years ago that you would not run against him because you were planning to run for president.
Yes.
Why does the governor of Georgia, after 2 years in office, decide 4 years in advance that he's going to run for president of the United States?
Well, Mr. Broder, a lot of reasons. It would be hard to explain on a program this short all the reasons I'd like to run. First of all, I think we have a nation that is truly great. Not that used to be great or someday will be great again, but one that has an innate character about it that's not adequately recognized. A stability, a pride in its past, an economic strength that is presently not recognized adequately by the people in this country and around the world. I have executive management ability. I think part of the reason that our nation has been weakened to some degree is that the government mechanism itself in Washington has not been managed adequately. I have run the Georgia state government. I'm a businessman, I'm a planner, I'm a scientist, an engineer. I think I have the ability to manage the complicated mechanism of government. Also, I think there's a lack of purpose in our country's government now, which is much more vulnerable than the people deserve. It's hard to detect what are our goals, what common purpose we work toward, what sort of sacrifices might be expected from the American people. And if I can exemplify the correction of some of the defects that have been brought in our government by politicians and not by the people, and help to restore the greatness of this country, then I'd like to do it. Those are some of the reasons, very briefly, that I would like to be president and have been planning on it for a long time.
Governor, 2 years ago, you made the nominating speech for Senator Jackson's candidacy for the presidential nomination. Now you are set up as an opposing candidate for him, and you claim to have the support of many of the former supporters of George McGovern. Yet 2 years ago, you were probably as bitterly opposed to George McGovern as any leader in the Democratic Party. Have you changed in these 2 years, or have they changed, or what's happened?
Well, both. I think any human being changes with changing circumstances, but I haven't changed my basic concepts. I did oppose George McGovern when he was running for the nomination. I supported George McGovern openly and well after he got the Democratic nomination. I nominated Scoop Jackson in 1972 because I had known Scoop for 25 years. He came down to Atlanta and asked me to give the nominating speech. That was my first convention. I nominated him, and I was very proud of the opportunity. Scoop is a good man, and I certainly wouldn't say anything against him. I intend to defeat him in the primary.
But just for the sake of the viewers who don't know much about your political philosophy,
yes,
are you closer to a George McGovern Democrat or a Scoop Jackson Democrat today?
I can't answer that question well. I think on civil rights, on environmental questions, that I would be considered to be very moderate or perhaps liberal. Liberal by Georgia standards, moderate by the standards of most of the rest of the nation. On business-like management of a government mechanism, on fiscal restraint, on refusing to waste the taxpayers' money, I think I would be considered to be a business quite conservative. It's hard for me to say. I'm not as hawkish as Senator Jackson on some aspects of foreign policy. I'm certainly not as liberal on many elements of importance to the American people as was George McGovern. I would put myself, in my opinion, above either one of them as a candidate for president.
Governor, in an address you made before the press club in February of 1973, you said, and I quote, "The mood of the people, in my opinion, is one of basic conservatism." How would you describe the mood of the people of this country today?
I went on in that speech to define what conservatism meant, and I think I use the word benevolent conservatism. I think this, to me, is a combination of recognizing that the government itself has a legitimate function to play in correcting defects in society, in taking the characteristics and afflictions of people and overcoming them and helping people individually to make the most of whatever talent God might have given them. At the same time, I think the mechanism of government itself has got to be well managed in order to deliver these kinds of services to our people, to preserve peace, to present to the rest of the world the accurate image that our nation is strong, that it has some purpose, that it has a basic integrity that can't be changed, of honesty and decency and enlightenment and compassion and even sometimes love, if that's a proper word to express the occasion.
May I pursue this just a little bit further? In the television interview recently, you said, again I quote, the Democratic Party will range from ultra-liberals to ultra-conservatives and most in between. Now, where do you yourself stand in that category, in those categories?
Well, I think I've kind of answered that question already. On matters that relate to human beings and the respect for them and the overcoming of afflictions and the equal rights associated with the civil rights movement and the preservation of the environment, I think I would take a liberal stance. On the tough business-like management of government, I would take a conservative stance. Anybody, for instance, in politics who appeals to the prejudice or hatred or doubts or fears or who would hurt another person, to me, is despicable, and I couldn't go along with that. And I don't know whether you would categorize that as liberal or conservative. But I think I would be a progressive, fairly moderate person with a tough business-like capability that the government needs. And I would say, to be perfectly frank, fairly liberal on environmental or civil rights matters.
Mr. Kiker.
Governor, it costs a lot of money to run for president these days. Where are you going to get yours?
Well, we have a very modest budget set up for next year of about $500,000, about half of which I intend to raise in Georgia and the rest of it outside the country. I will comply completely with the new campaign finance law from the very initiation of our campaign, which began the first couple of weeks in November. I think the American people are very eager to see political candidates be very modest in their acceptance of large campaign contributions. I think it's a travesty, for instance, of the new law, which will go into effect the 1st of January, and which limits contributions, to see some of the authors and supporters of that law trying to circumvent it by raising very large sums of money before the law goes into effect. So I'll be very open, very modest in my request for a lot of small campaign contributions, and I think I'll be successful.
Last weekend in Kansas City at the Democratic mini-convention, the Democrats adopted a new party charter. And the black delegates there threatened to walk out unless one article was strengthened to better ensure non-discrimination in delegate selection. Organized labor, specifically the AFL-CIO, is saying that this means implied quotas, minority quotas in 76. I'd like to ask you, how do you feel about the change that was made, and do you believe that that will be the result?
I favor the change that was made. The Georgia delegation voted unanimously for it, including the president of the Georgia State AFL-CIO. I don't think that labor will walk out or leave. I think it's best perhaps for some of the larger labor unions to support individual candidates rather than being tied to a particular party. And I think that this convention was very helpful for the Democrats.
Mr. Apple.
Governor, you have told us several times that you want to take a business-like attitude towards the management of the government. You've resisted our attempts to get you to describe yourself as a liberal or a conservative. Let me ask you about one specific issue that may help. I think most people in Washington agree that if federal spending is going to be cut substantially, which you seem to indicate you would favor, you're going to have to cut a substantial amount out of the military budget. Would you do that? And if so, out of what areas of the military budget?
Mr. Apple, I spent 11 years in the Navy. I'm a graduate of Annapolis. I did my work in nuclear physics as a nuclear submariner. I've stayed in very close touch with the military on matters of nuclear disarmament, on organizational structure of the military. There's a horrible amount of waste right now in the Pentagon budget, and it hasn't been adequately supervised by the civilian leaders of this country. As I said in my speech the other day, for instance, the Chief of Naval Operations has more captains on his staff than there are in all the ships at sea put together. And the organizational structure of the armed forces ought to be modified, and a great deal of saving could be made there. Also, we're putting too much emphasis on the escalation in nuclear weaponry. I think we need an adequate Navy, for instance, to protect sea lanes and to let this nation pursue its peacetime policies, instead of putting such an enormous amount of our resources financially into weapons that are just designed to kill civilians. And I think there are many ways that we can hold down military spending and at the same time have a defense establishment that is adequate, and I would certainly always maintain that, but at the same time be more fitting in with this nation's basic policy of peaceful existence with other nations.
Would you favor, assuming that the present SALT agreement is approved, would you favor a strategic weapons building program below the levels agreed to by President Ford at Vladivostok?
Yes. And I would also pursue on a private and public basis fairly drastic reductions in nuclear weapons. I think this nation ought to have as its ultimate goal zero nuclear weapons for any nation in the world.
Are you willing to take unilateral steps in that direction?
No, I would not. But, for instance, I think if this nation pursued aggressively an elimination completely of anti-ballistic missiles at this time, I think the Russians might very well accept this proposition. I would propose it. There never has yet been any pursuit made of reducing tactical nuclear weapons, which we own and which the Russians own by the thousands. Also, I think that it's ridiculous for us and Russia to race toward a concept where we can have 2,400 major missiles with MIRVs on about half of them. We don't need that many. And I think that if we made a public issue of it, that the world opinion might help us to induce Russia to reduce.
Go ahead, Johnny.
Do we need that many if the Russians have that many? That's what I'm trying to get at.
Not necessarily. The fact that the Russians have 2,400 major missiles, 1,300 of which are MIRVed, and we have 2,000 missiles, 1,200 of which are MIRVed, is not particularly significant. We both have vast overkill capability. And I think the marshaling of worldwide support for a position that we would take to reduce nuclear weapons would receive very favorable attention, and I think it would induce the Russians to reduce their spending as well.
Mr. Van der Linden.
Governor, let's presume that you are already president.
Yes, sir.
Would you follow the present policy of support to Israel in the Middle East, or would you be bound to preserve Israel as an independent nation there?
Van der Linden, in my opinion, one of the most important bases on which we could must build the future of our nation, its economic existence, and to honor the commitments that we have already made is to guarantee the integrity of the State of Israel.
But could you do that, sir, if you cut back the defense budget because we now have a shortage of modern tanks for the United States forces? We had to pull some of ours from Germany to go into Israel at the time of the October War. There are no tanks left. Would you increase the defense budget in that regard?
I would certainly not cut back the military budget if it meant abandoning our commitment for the preservation of the integrity of the State of Israel. And I think that an important aspect of that is to continue to provide arms for Israel so that they can defend themselves. But this is something that would have to be addressed in detail, you know, after I was in office, but I would never yield on that point. And I think it's very important for the American government to make this quite clear to the rest of the world. And I think it would be a very serious mistake for any political candidate to try to use the Israeli threat to Israel, as a political platform plank, because this has always been, up till now, a bipartisan or a nonpartisan, quietly accepted principle of our American government's foreign policy. And it ought to be expressed very clearly by all candidates, but not used as a political football, which I think would hurt this particular concept or part of our national existence and our national commitment.
Gentlemen, we have less than 2 minutes. Mr. Broder.
Governor, first a quick follow-up on something you said to Mr. Kiker about, as I understood it, some of your rivals in this situation, I believe you said, are trying to circumvent the intent of the law by raising large sums of money in advance of it going into effect. Who are you speaking of?
I read an article in the New York Times this morning that pointed out that the two senatorial prospective candidates, Senator Jackson and Senator Benson, were attempting to raise large sums of money before the 1st of January when the law goes into effect. Both of these gentlemen supported the limitation of a $1,000 contribution limit on any particular person to a candidate. I personally believe that this is typical of the Washington bureaucracy, where they deliberately made the law effective long months after it was signed by the president and passed by them. I think this is equivalent to the same thing that President Nixon did back in April of 1972 when he rapidly accumulated large sums of money to finance his campaign without revealing the identity of the contributors. So I think just the spirit of the law is being violated, although I hasten to say that these two gentlemen are not doing anything that's illegal.
I'm sorry, Governor. I'm sorry to interrupt, but our time is up. Thank you, Governor Carter, for being with us today on Meet the Press. I'll tell you about next week's guest in just a minute after this message.
This is Meeting Street in Charleston, South Carolina. And this is Charlie Batson. He's been running an Exxon station here for 51 years.
We've been here so long, since 1923, of course. I haven't come in there four generations. I've seen them start off and retire.
If you travel a few more blocks down Meeting Street, you'll find another Exxon station. This one is run by Charlie's brother, Teddy Batson. He's also been with Exxon for a long time.
I've been in business 50 years, 1 year less than Charlie. You meet new friends and old friends and people that come from far away that we see year after year, and it's really a great pleasure to greet them back.
When you've been at something a long time, you get to be very good at it. Exxon is proud of its many dealers who have been at it for a long time. For a printed copy of today's interview, send 10 cents in coin and a stamp, self-addressed envelope to Merkle Press, Box 2111, Washington, D.C., 20013.
Next Sunday on Meet the Press, our guest will be Dr. Walter W. Heller, one of the nation's leading economists. Now, this is Lawrence Spivak saying goodbye for Governor Jimmy Carter and Meet the Press.
Meet the Press has been brought to you by Exxon.
UN Ambassador John Scali talks about a world organization that some say may be in deep trouble. Beatle John Lennon makes a rare in-depth television appearance. The American Ballet Theater is on stage, and there's a look at men's fashions and the lifestyle they reflect. All on the Today program this week on NBC. This is Lee Dayton speaking.